We've all seen the before and after photos of Dubai. In 1991, it was a desert landscape with just a few buildings. But now it's a popular holiday destination with aquariums, inner hotel rooms, and the world's tallest building. At the heart of how this happened is oil, the black gold, which has been at the root of revolutions, trade wars, and empires. But while the skyscrapers have gone up in the United Arab Emirates, glaciers around the world have collapsed because of our unwavering reliance on fossil fuels. More recently, Russia's war in Ukraine has focused our attention on energy policies like never before, and what happens in Europe has a deep impact on our pockets as energy prices surge. My conversation with Professor Michael Bradshaw illuminates all these topics, as he's the go-to man on global energy. He's tracked Russia's energy policies for decades and is one of the few people who has a chance of predicting what our energy markets might look like in the next year.
We're stuck there in a very competitive world. Now, I mean, we may be global Britain, but we're by ourselves. The problem is that to know how much gas we've got, we need to drill to kind of catch 22. I mean, I'm often accused of being a bit like Eeyore in, you know, sort of full of bad news. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, it's like saying, well, can we use the current crisis to actually accelerate the pace of change to do what we should already be doing?
That's Professor Michael Bradshaw on how energy policies shape our lives with me, Will Hutton, for the We Society, brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Hello and welcome. Today I'm talking to Professor Michael Bradshaw, who works at the intersection of multiple fields, international relations, geography and business. One could argue that he's an archetypal social scientist whose research untangles some of the most complicated political questions of our time. As a professor of global energy at Warwick Business School and the co-director of the UK Energy Research Centre, he follows the high drama linked to energy production and trade. With a focus on US energy and UK gas security, Mike's research has never been more important, as must be obvious to all of you listening in. Mike, thanks for making the time to join us on the We Society.
Nice to be here.
When we got in contact with you and said, you know, we'd love to do a podcast on the We Society and how it hooks in with the world of kind of energy consumption, energy supply, and all that follows on from that. What was your first thought? What kind of, We Society, why me? Or did you think automatically, obviously, I should be talking on this podcast series?
Well, I think the last few months, everyone's mind's been focused on the cost of energy, and that's sort of driven people to understand the centrality to what I would call energy services and everything that we do. And I think also people have had a sort of a lesson in global energy, understanding that what happens in other parts of the world, some very far flung, impacts directly on what we have to pay to heat our homes and to run our vehicles. So I think it's suddenly become something everyone's taken an interest in and affects our cost of living and our living standards.
Could we have done more over the decades, you know, the last few decades, to emphasize the we in energy supply? Could we have done more to make ourselves more resilient, to make our supply more secure, to have organized a better transition to more diverse sources of energy? I mean, has there been too little we, basically, in the thinking about energy?
I think maybe we've been complacent. I mean, we live in what I would call a high energy society. We take for granted 24/7 access to energy services at a relatively low cost. And that's when we've come to realize, firstly, of course, that one of the costs of our energy profligacy, if you want to call it that, is climate change, that, you know, the fossil fuel economy is 70% of global emissions. But we've also realized that, you know, this reliance on fossil fuels, the prices are very volatile, boom and bust. That's not good for anyone. It's not good for the producers of those fossil fuels who have to manage their economies. It's not good for consumers. And of course, most recently, writ large, we've seen that some of the pathologies associated with being an oil and gas exporter, you know, the tendency to support autocratic governments, is actually a real threat to everyone's security.
Yeah, I mean, we've moved from a world in which energy was, you know, dominated by state producers. I mean, I grew up with the Central Electricity Generating Board, and actually publicly owned energy and gas production and distribution. I grew up in a world in which there were long-term contracts, in which suppliers signed, you know, long-term contracts for sometimes years and years at, you know, stable prices for them, stable prices for us, the consumer. And that was all torched. And we moved to this kind of market-based, kind of company-driven, it's all about incentives, it's all about the spot market. And suddenly we find, actually, there are big, big downsides with this world. I mean, you could characterize it as moving from a world of we to a world of kind of I and an individualistic approach to kind of producing and consuming energy.
I think that's a fair observation. I'd say two things, perhaps. One, first, of course, there are large parts of the world where, you know, the state still owns the energy infrastructure, or the state intervenes in markets, and there is a prevalence of long-term contracts. That's still the dominant way that Asia gets its gas in the form of liquefied natural gas. But it's certainly the case in the UK and more generally in Europe of late that we move to a much more kind of neoliberal laissez-faire market system. And if you look at the way that the UK government actually defines energy security, it's always tended to focus on what I call physical security of supply, which actually ends up being, have we got enough pipes and terminals to physically deliver the energy we need? And have we got a diversity of sources of supply? You know, have we got a variety of different countries providing that energy? And then they simply say, we rely on market signals to deliver the gas that we need, which has introduced another dimension of energy security, which is a notion of price security. And I think we've had a very hard lesson of learning that in this market economy with a reliance on short-term prices and competition, you can have the physical security, the gas that you need or the oil that you need, as long as you're prepared to pay the necessary price. And in situations of short supply, the laws of supply and demand simply drive the price up. And that's what's happened. I think also we are increasingly conscious of issues to do with energy poverty, you know, which is defined in this country as households spending more than 10% of their income on energy services. That has been a concern, and it's very much a concern today. But it's not really, you know, those volatile prices and the high price are something households can't manage, and yet they bear the brunt. So it works when prices are low and there's abundant supply. But when there are constraints on supply or demand accelerates, you end up with tight markets and high prices. Obviously, the theory is that the market then readjusts and there's more investment and supply balances. But in the current context, we have a third element, which you might call geopolitical security, where we are making a decision not to import our energy from particular countries or a particular country, which is tightening the supply.
We're not going to buy any Russian oil and gas.
And then, therefore, we have to find our supplies from a smaller source of supply. And the whole of Europe is making this decision, and it's leading to increased competition and high prices.
There's a couple of avenues we could go down here. I'd like to kind of explore more about this. You know, something like 60% of households in this country have gross incomes of £32,000-£33,000 or less. And then they've got to pay tax and national insurance on that. And even above that, a couple of grand on these additional energy bills. I mean, it's absolutely crucifying for people's budgets. And I'm wondering, you know, could we have done better at insulating people from this? I mean, the French are boasting that actually they've capped it almost completely. Other countries around Europe have had a mix of policies, but no one has kind of imposed upon their public this kind of energy price increase, this complete exposure to a spot market and kind of geopolitical events beyond our control. I mean, you spend your life on this. What do you think about it?
Well, I mean, it is a cap in a sense. It's not allowing, it's averaging out the variation, because we had one point where the gas prices were literally going through the roof. But I understand what you're saying. I mean, I think, from my perspective, it's very difficult to see how you can do anything in the energy market to address it. Because one of the problems we've had with the price cap is that essentially you were putting a cap on what companies in the retail market could charge customers. And the problem was that many of those companies didn't have long-term contracts themselves.
I know. So what, 30 or something?
30 went bust.
30? Yeah. I mean, these are astonishing numbers. I mean, in any other walk of life, you'd be thinking this is economic carnage. Yeah.
Well, yes, and I think Ofgem has had a study done to understand why.
Ofgem is, just to be clear,
is the regulator for the oil and gas market. But I think it was clear to everyone. It comes back to your question about competition, that the government had wanted to give the impression of having a competitive energy market by allowing lots of companies to play in the retail market. But Ofgem as a regulator didn't pay enough attention to the financial resilience of those companies. So lots of companies set up and actually were basically financing what they were doing by the standing orders that people were paying. And so when the price went up, they had committed to give to deliver electricity and gas at a price that was way below the market price, couldn't cover their costs, they went bust. So that's part of the problem. If intervening in the market, it comes down to, okay, so if you were to subsidize the price of electricity, or say the price of gas in the UK, we still have to pay that global price to get the gas to come to the UK. Who's going to cover the difference? Somewhere along the line, it's all well and good for the French government. I mean, the Hungarian government controls a lot of prices, but that's a form of subsidy, and somewhere that's having to be paid for.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, the French have got... the figure is, I think it's close to 60% of their energy does come from nuclear. Is it 56%? Something of that order, anyway. And that is now, even allowing for kind of the cost of disposing of nuclear waste, I mean, it's significantly cheaper than anything happening in the oil and gas markets.
That's true. And we have a share, about 20% of our base load that's still nuclear. And we have days, we basically have an electricity system today, which is nuclear base load with intermittent renewables, primarily offshore wind, and gas fills a bit in the middle. It covers the intermittency. So there are days, windy days, where we don't actually consume a lot of gas. But the cost of production for that renewables and nuclear is much lower than when we have these very high gas prices. But the renewable generators are getting the electricity price, which has been pushed up by the gas price. Some of them have to pay that back because they have this thing called a contract for difference, where they've got a guaranteed price from the government. I mean, I'm not an expert on electricity markets. They're incredibly complicated, particularly so it seems within Europe and within the UK. But I do know that this is an issue that we are now looking at to understand how we might price things differently. Some of my colleagues at UKIRC have talked about trying to separate
the UK Energy Research Centre,
trying to separate out that low carbon, cheaper energy from the gas element. And one other way of looking at
it. You said one of the things we're looking at, and we want to do.
Yeah.
Who's the we here?
Well, these are my colleagues, people who have got bigger brains than I who work on electricity markets, who are trying to think about electricity market design, how you might reform it. And they've talked about a sort of a net zero basket where you would have one part of the electricity market that's basically that renewable sector. But another way of looking at it is to think that the role of gas in our energy system has changed. Yes, 85% of households in the UK have a gas boiler. That's critically important, and that's a major problem going into next winter. But gas in power has fallen quite a bit. But it's actually there as a source of flexible power to flex when we don't have wind and sun. So the system is changing, and we need to think about how we can make the pricing of that system change as well. So there's probably work that can be done there to try and think about ways that we can share the benefits of lower cost renewables. Because it's all well and good saying, well, onshore wind is the cheapest form of power generation in the UK. But if your gas price is setting the electricity price, it doesn't matter.
But that's, I'm descending into a hall of mirrors here, really. I mean, Why should the gas price determines the electricity price, which determines my bill? That's because you want to make sure that the marginal producer, the last producer, can bring their production into kind of the grid if they're needed, and we have to pay top whack to get them in. I mean, it's all kind of. Don't you want a world? I mean, don't you want a world like the one we used to have? I mean, where you have, these are natural utilities, a publicly owned grid, long-term contracts, embedded resilience, and we just, that's what we go for. And we want to turn on the light and know what the price is going to be, rather than live in this amazing world in which we have descended.
Yeah, I mean, I think you raise an important point. And I would add to the complexity in some ways to say that, it's not only that we want those energy services, but we want them in a low carbon way going forward. And it raises questions about the ability of the market to deliver net zero, for example, and whether actually the state has to grasp the nettle here. And for, in the short term, has to be more interventionist because of price security, but longer term, more interventionist to deliver the net zero energy system that we need to address climate change. And I think those debates need to be had. The current government seems to be quite happy just to set targets, then increase the targets to say it solved the problem, and put a huge reliance on the private sector and the market to deliver. And it's not delivering at the pace required. So maybe there is an opportunity in the midst of a tragic situation in Ukraine and a global energy price crisis to actually say, well, maybe we need to go back to fundamentals here.
Before we carry on the conversation, just a quick word about the organisation behind the podcast series. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body established in 1982. It's for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. As the leading independent voice in the UK, it champions the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, and in business. What is that role? Well, social sciences help us to understand the human world. That means solving grand challenges like climate change, wealth creation, or energy crises. It might mean working out the practicalities of levelling up the regions of Britain, monitoring happiness, maintaining standards of education, or addressing racial equality. Or it could be providing vital context for issues affecting public health, or working out a better way for our cities to be designed and planned. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Or you can follow us on Twitter at @AcadSocSciences. You'll find those details in our show notes. So, back to the conversation. And then we have this situation where, suddenly, you mentioned this yourself, that actually it isn't just, world of supply and demand. There's all this geostrategy. And actually, we don't want to buy Russian oil and gas. I mean, the European Union is now collectively organising itself to use its collective buying power and try and drive great bargains for itself, security supply, long-term contracts. The Americans want the same. The Chinese want the same. And there's little UK kind of outside all these blocks with its energy supplies dependent on the spot market. I mean, we're just a kind of cork bouncing about in global waves, aren't we?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm deeply sceptical that this notion of collective bargaining is going to work in the European Union. I think one of the problems with the politicians and a lot of the rhetoric we've had of late is that, and it's also part of the way we analyse the energy system and talk about geopolitics, we get the statistics by country and we think that country A is trading with country B. Now, in some instances, you take Saudi Arabia, it's Saudi Aramco because it's a national oil company that has a state monopoly. But certainly in Europe, the energy trade is the business of companies. And as we've already discussed, I mean, those companies are privately owned. They're driven by desire for return on investment. It makes it very difficult for the state to intervene and dictate. But the European Union certainly is getting a bit more heavy-handed in that respect. And companies themselves are self-sanctioning. They're stopping buying Russian oil, even when there is no state sanction in place. As to the position of the UK, I think in some ways, unfortunately, we found ourselves between a rock and a hard place in the sense that we're no longer part of the European Union. We don't have a seat at the table that's discussing strategy in Europe. And Europe has its own policy, the Repower EU policy, and hopes not just to move away from Russian gas, but
it's
actually
Repower EU.
Yeah.
So Repower EU.
Yeah, yeah. So it really hopes to, in the short term, to try and get some easy gains in terms of efficiency and demand reduction, like turning a thermostat down, for example, next winter. But also wants to find alternative sources of supply to avoid Russia, but then wants to massively accelerate the rate of deployment of renewables. So it's not just a matter. So we get to 2030, we're not no longer buying Russian oil and gas, but actually we're not consuming as much oil and gas because we have accelerated the low carbon transition. And maybe that's a positive outcome because the pace of progress of the transition, you know, COP26 seems like many, many years ago, but it was only last November in Glasgow when we were talking about powering past coal and, you know, phasing down fossil fuels, is that maybe in the name of energy security, we can accelerate that. So we're sitting there looking at what Europe's doing, and actually we are totally exposed to Europe's energy diplomacy with Russia, not because of our physical reliance on Russian gas, but because the way it impacts on price. At the same time, we're having to compete with other buyers of liquefied natural gas globally, particularly in Asia, to get the gas that we need. So, you know, we're stuck there in a very competitive world. Now, I mean, we may be global Britain, but we're by ourselves.
That is a very telling phrase. We may be global Britain, but we're by ourselves. We've actually, in a sense, we've kind of detached ourselves from the European we. I mean, a cold wind is blowing very strongly. Will it be all right in the end?
Well, maybe we'll have the same ambitions. I mean, if you think back to, you know, we've had previous crises, energy crises, it did drive a desire to be more efficient. And if nothing else, switch off the lights, you know, so maybe in very difficult situations.
Well, of course, there is that. I mean, there is that. We can all turn our thermostats down. We can all turn our, you know, rooms could be no more than, I don't know, 16 degrees centigrade. I mean, I'm plucking a finger out of the air, but we could all drive no faster than 50 miles an hour on the motorway. And, you know, we can all switch the lights out and read by candlelight. I mean... we can turn the clock back to kind of 1875 and live like that.
Stranger things have happened. But if you look, for example, at the impact of the Fukushima disaster in Japan with the earthquake and the tsunami and the nuclear power system shutting down, they lost 30% of their power generation overnight. They took drastic measures then, which had an impact on energy demand 3 or 4 years down the line. People, you know, they changed their behaviors.
What were those measures they took?
Well, you know, a lot of them, one among many was switching off their electric toilets. It's not a problem we probably have in the UK. But, you know, things like
I have to say, Japanese electric, for those who have never experienced a Japanese electric toilet, is quite something. And I've never managed to master it. Water comes everywhere.
quite a surprise.
So they, and you switch those off and you save from power, yeah.
But even simple things like, you know, etiquette in dress and going to work, stop wearing suits, don't wear ties, you know, don't have the air conditioning up so high, all those kind of measures, plus being more cautious with your use of energy in the home. And actually it turns out that further down the line also people start to buy, I mean, they replace their old white goods with more efficient white goods because they're more energy conscious. You know, so all of those things have a benefit. Now, it's not going to help get us through. Some of these things will help us get through the winter. I know that the current government, you know, doesn't want to dictate. It doesn't like the idea of the nanny state. I don't think it needs to dictate because I think the high cost of energy is going to motivate people.
But the nanny state, this is something I can resolve from, really. I do get why people talk about the nanny state, but another way of thinking about the state is it is maybe imperfect, but it's a way of representing the collective, the we, and asserting we-ness in energy policy. I mean, it's not nannying; it's actually making sure that actually people don't have to confront over 18-month period £2,000 increase in their energy bills.
So,
Of course, I mean, if there was a Tory MP sitting here, he would be saying, what about fracking? Yeah. Come on. Well, this is an absurd conversation. I mean, you two are talking yourselves into a complete kind of pessimism. With one bound, we could be free. This country's got billions of cubic feet of gas below the ground. All we've got to do is frack it.
Yeah.
You say, yeah? What do you mean?
Well, fracking is one of those questions I spent far too much time researching over the years. It was something that I got interested in almost 10 years ago now, I suppose. I was interested in what was happening in the United States. You know, very quickly this industry was developing. It wasn't
amazing. I mean, it's turned America, into the United States of America, into being not only self-sufficient, but an oil exporter.
Absolutely.
Again. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, and the terminals now that export natural gas from the United States were initially built to import it and never did, you know. So I think politicians in Europe saw the shale revolution taking place in the United States and quite understandably said, well, like, we'll have some of that. But I think, I mean, right across Europe, there was quite a lot of public resistance to that because then they saw things like the movie Gaslands, which was showing people's taps catching on fire and whatever, and people became concerned about the environmental impacts and whether it was compatible with climate change. Now, in the UK, we had a government that famously said, we're going all out for shale, and then spectacularly failed to deliver, partly because the industry that had never really got to be of any significant scale in the UK. There were questions about whether we've got all that gas under the ground.
As far as I understand it, I mean, the geology is such that actually it's tricky to do without triggering kind of landslips and earthquakes and earth movements in densely populated parts of the country and all that follows from that. And there's not that much anyway to get.
Well,
so the whole thing becomes kind of profoundly uneconomic because by the time you protect yourself from all of the kind of earth movements and not to get much gas, what's the point?
The problem is that to know how much gas we've got, we need to drill.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of catch 22. Until we've actually
and
drilled.
I'd be accused of being a damn pessimist, or kind of, yeah.
Well, yes, but it is associated with small earthquakes. And actually, I mean, the government put in place a moratorium back in 2019 because the first proper commercial attempts to explore, the company Quadrilla working in the north of England, in Lancashire, had drilled wells and had triggered some earthquakes. And we have a simple traffic light system that if the earthquake is of a certain magnitude, you have to stop operating. Well, it triggered a set of earthquakes, which were quite unexpected. The drilling stopped. The scientists in the government and elsewhere pored over the data. And then the government put in place a moratorium. It just happened that moratorium was in the run-up to a general election, and they were concerned. You know, they saw possibilities of doing well in the north of England, one might say. That moratorium has stayed in place until recently, in the midst of the gas price crisis and now the war in Ukraine. We've had, backbenchers.
At least find out.
Let's find out by drilling is
the cry.
So the pressure has been to lift the moratorium. Now, the moratorium was placed on, and the government's position was, well, we'll only lift it if there's new science to show that it can be, the earthquake risk can be managed. And we're still in the midst of waiting for the report from the British Geological Survey. My view is, even if you lifted it tomorrow, it's not going to make a difference because the business model for shale gas is quite different from conventional gas. A conventional gas field, you drill a relatively small number of wells and you get a lot of gas out of those wells for a long period of time. Okay, it costs you a lot of money to drill those wells, but you get a lot of gas for a long time. With a shale well, each well you drill, you get a relatively small amount of gas, but it peaks very quickly and then declines, which means to keep production going, you've got to keep drilling, hence the term drill baby drill. That shale gas means constantly drilling.
I always thought that was a rock and roll song, actually. Yeah. Drill baby drill.
Yeah, well, it probably is. but that's the model. And I can't conceive of a situation where we have hundreds of drilling rigs roaming around the north of England, drilling hundreds, if not thousands, of wells to generate gas. Because every one of those wells has generated a huge amount of public opposition and a long drawn out planning inquiry.
Listening to this, there may be activists from Extinction Rebellion, Greenpeace, Just Stop Oil. I mean, energy really gets people's gut and they want to get out there and dramatically show us that the public at large, we've got to change. How do you react to them? I mean, do you think good on you? Do you think yes, but? I mean, what's your reaction?
Probably a bit of both. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the cause. I mean, I listen to what they're saying. I think, you know, their intent, they're full of the right intent. But the yes, but might be that sort of looking at the evidence as to how quickly we can do some of the things that they want. I think thinking back to what Extinction Rebellion was wanting, like a zero carbon energy system by 2025, it's just not possible to deliver at that pace. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't constantly be reminded of the urgency that we have a climate emergency and we've got to get on with it. So I don't have a problem at all with them protesting and raising the issue and driving home the importance of education. I think that's all part and parcel of it. But, you know, at the end of the day, the pace at which we as a society can move has to be taken into consideration. And equally, sometimes the unforeseen consequences of some of the things that they do also are for them to consider, I think. So take you back to the sort of the shale gas dispute and the communities impacted by the shale gas dispute. Social science research looking at how communities received, being the focal point of an environmental campaign was all well and good, but the campaigners probably had as bigger impact as anyone in terms of the disruption that they caused. And it also can become a divisive issue in society. I mean, people are welcome to their own view, but in the liberal democracy that we live in, they also have to be willing to accept the point of view of others. In some communities, this can become really quite divisive issues, and they impact on people, and they disrupted people's lives for a very long period of time. In general, yes, I'm all in favor of it, and I think, it conveys that sense of urgency. But with the social scientist in me wants to look at the evidence and say, well, there is a limit to how quickly we can move. It's certainly the case we are not doing anywhere near the level of investment and that scale of urgency that we need to address these problems. But we can't address them overnight. You have to be realistic.
Let's hammer this out in 30 seconds, top whack. How would you sequence what investment, first, second, and third, in what scale, to get to the results that Extinction Rebellion want, even if you don't get there as soon as 2025?
I mean, I think one of their causes has been about improving home insulation and improving the thermal efficiency of housing so that people can heat their homes. And I think, in the current emergency situation we face, those kind of initiatives are extremely important. I mean, I know the Chancellor's removed VAT on many of these materials, but it comes back to behavioural decisions, but it also comes back to having a supply chain to make it happen. So helping people do as much as they can.
Number two,
it's I would say the planning system is also a large part of the problem here, but the planning system is also the means by which local people protest. But at the end of the day, you can't protest about everything,
So when you say plan, you want to get more wind farms up sooner.
Well, I think it's really interesting that
For example,
communities who want to have wind farms, who have bought into some kind of community development program, either with a company or
whatever. Give them a share.
Give them the opportunity to go ahead with that.
Okay, so that's one, two, three.
Ooh, three. What would be the third one? I think EV charging points, it's a complete disaster.
It is. It's a calamity. I know. I have friends with electric cars and, they've got not much range. A journey that should take, a few hours in a petrol car or a diesel car, perish the thought, will take 11, 12, 13 hours. Yeah. We can't go on like this.
Yeah, yeah. So improving efficiency of our homes, looking at the planning system and EV charging infrastructure. I think those are short-term wins which can be delivered.
I just put myself in your shoes and be, and do what you do. I mean, you're scenario building, you're sketching out options. But I mean, do you ever despair?
I think you have to be a glass half full. I mean, I'm often accused of being a bit like Eeyore in, sort of full of bad news. But I think, at the end of the day, it's like saying, well, can we use the current crisis to actually accelerate the pace of change, to do what we should already be doing? There's part of that in the strategy of our own government. But I think I said to someone kind of sort of tongue in cheek, you can't build a strategy around Armageddon. That's not the way to do it. It's to look for, I think one of the things you need to look for in all of this is co-benefits or win-wins. You're going to do this for a reason. That reason might not be to reduce the carbon emissions, but it might be to reduce your energy consumption because you can't afford the high cost of energy. You create those co-benefits all the time where there are positive benefits for doing something the motivation may be quite different, but the consequences are positive for the climate.
Mike, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating conversation. And just thinking what we've learned in this last kind of over this conversation, we've learned that we're all exposed. We've learned that actually the migration from a world of kind of the state being involved in energy distribution, production, and supply to a world of spot market prices may have looked good 10, 20, 30 years ago, but it doesn't look so clever today. We've learned that there may be a kind of silver lining within the cloud of these high gas prices, in that they may force us to move to transition to greener energy than we would otherwise have done. We've discussed Britain being alone, and that that could be, we don't yet know for certain, that could be a very risky place to be as the geopolitics of this works out, of big blocs doing deals with each other and actually trying to avoid doing deals with Russia. And we've learned that you may think that, that your household energy bill is a kind of just hits you to the solar plexus as you face some of these stunning bills. But actually, if you want to solve it, you can't do it. You can't do much as an individual. You can turn the light off. You can turn the thermostat down. You can drive slower. But ultimately, you do require a we to act to structure these markets in a way that your gas bill and your electricity bill are more reasonable. Thank you, Mike. That's been a really interesting, very interesting conversation. Thank you.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
And that's the last in this series of the We Society podcasts. We're back again in the autumn with another group of podcasts, which I hope you'll enjoy just as much as I hope you have done this group of podcasts. We certainly, the whole team, has really enjoyed putting them together, talking to leading social scientists, practitioners, trying to figure out why the world is as it is and what we can do to try and make it better. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production.